Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome another group of students from Golda Meir School for Gifted and Talented. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program, a national award-winning program, that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they're sent materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities relating to the case. They come for an oral argument, and then they meet a justice of the court after this second case, and the discussion relates to the procedures of the court in hearing a case and deciding a case. There will be no discussion of the substantive issues relating to the case. If anyone here would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we'll be happy to supply it. The marshal will give you a copy. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. She's the justice with whom you will meet after this case to discuss the court. Seated to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. To his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to Justice Crooks's left, Justice Pat Rogensack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today, 10 AP 1523D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Joseph W. Weigel. Representing the respondent appellant, Mr. Weigel, is attorney Terry E. Johnson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing before you to speak on behalf of Joseph Weigel, the respondent appellant. Mr. Weigel is a 50-year veteran of the bar who has served his community, the bar, and this court over those 50 years. He now stands before you accused of having violated several different Supreme Court rules with a request by the Office of Lawyer Regulation, approved of by the referee, that his license to practice law be suspended for 60 days. It is our position that, however much we may disagree with some of the findings that were made by the referee, under the rules of this court, we can no longer contest some of the findings in at least one violation, but that we do believe the referee erred in concluding that some rules were violated, and that she severely erred in part because of the error in determining which counts have been proven in determining discipline, and that although we believe you will have to determine that at least one set of rules, the rules relating to advertising, based on the findings that were made by the referee, have been established, the discipline should be a substantially lesser discipline. The three sets of rules that have been incorporated into this are, first of all, violations relating to the fact that Mr. Weigel entered into a non-compete agreement with an attorney who was leaving his firm for all practical purposes, and thereafter made a brief, extremely brief, mistaken effort to enforce that before he stopped that. Second of all, that the firm misused the Eisenberg surname in a couple of ways for a brief period of time following Mr. Alvin Eisenberg's departure from the firm. And third, that the referee firm has had an improper fee-sharing arrangement with a paralegal. On the basis of this, the referee recommended a 60-day suspension. We believe that on the basis of those allegations which have been proven, the only discipline which makes any sense is a public reprimand. To be more specific, the court should conclude that because the referee never found that Mr. Eisenberg was practicing law before the 1999 agreement by which he changed his relationship with the firm and sold his stock, that the restriction contained in that agreement was in fact part of an agreement from the practice of law, for retirement from the practice of law, and as such did not violate the rules dealing with restrictive covenants. Second, the court should conclude that although, based on the findings of the referee, with which we disagree, but under the rules which we cannot contest at this point, that although Mr. Weigel and his firm did err in the ways in which they used Mr. Eisenberg's surname, that use was understandable and doesn't by any way bespeak lack of fitness to practice law and should be viewed in that context. Most importantly, the court should conclude that both OLR and the referee are simply mistaken in their conclusions about the fee-sharing arrangement, that they have attempted to rewrite the rules of this court to cover a situation which perhaps should be addressed by the rules of this court. We take no position on that, but which clearly is not encompassed by the only rule that's cited, because, in fact, there never was any sharing of fees with the paralegal unless my law firm and every other law firm that practices in private practice shares fees with paralegals and with secretaries and with office administrators and with accountants, because all of us pay our employees from the only source of income we have, the fees we get from our clients, and that the fee-sharing arrangement, the fee-sharing prohibition, is clearly, under the language of the rule and the cases cited, a prohibition upon making specific arrangements to share the fees in specific cases with specific non-lawyers. And in this case, there simply never was an arrangement of that type. And in fact, the finding by the referee demonstrates that she didn't find a finding of that type.
So bonuses are okay.
Bonuses are okay. Compensation's okay. In this case, what the evidence suggests on that finding, and that's the one that I'd like to spend the most time on with you today if I can, what the evidence indicates, not our view of it, but uncontrovertedly, there simply is no dispute. And although the referee omitted making findings on this subject, I don't believe you'll hear Mr. Schwarzenbart say anything but this. The evidence was undisputed as to what happened here. The firm had two different bonus programs properly defined by the referee and her finding, under which, based upon gross recoveries, as the referee stated. And the gross recoveries term, I don't think is intended to be misleading, but in the context of this fee-sharing allegation, could become misleading. The gross recovery is not the recovery the law firm made for fees. The gross recovery is the recovery that the client made in that case. The law firm in question, Weigel Carlson Blau and Clemens, formerly known as Eisenberg Weigel Carlson Blau and Clemens, I hope I won't have to say that again either, but that law firm is primarily a plaintiff's personal injury firm, also does workers' compensation and Social Security work. All of those cases are handled on contingent fees. The evidence is absolutely undisputed that the program under which one paralegal gets a monthly and quarterly bonus, I believe, it's properly spelled out by the referee in her findings, is based upon her performance in obtaining recoveries for clients. It's measured in one instance by just the gross recovery. She gets a minuscule portion of those gross recoveries. And second of all, if the gross recoveries within her, what I would call her unit, exceed monthly goals, the gross recoveries for the clients, she gets another small percentage of the money by which it exceeds that.
What does she have to do with obtaining recovery?
She is instrumental in putting cases together, obtaining information, amassing.
On the basis of her work as a paralegal in that case.
Yes, in that group of cases each month, each quarter. And the evidence is clear. She is, at least in my experience with paralegals, an extraordinarily capable, qualified, and hardworking person.
What would be a fee-sharing arrangement then?
Fee-sharing arrangement would be if Mr. Weigel or if I'll personalize it with myself, if I entered into an arrangement with a paralegal that said, your next-door neighbor brought this case, came to the firm. I know this person came to the firm because you recommended us. We'll give you 10% of the fee on this case. We'll give
you a finder's fee.
What?
A finder's fee.
Finder's fee. If I told her, you know what, you've done a very good job on this case. As a result, we've decided to give you 10% of the fee on that case. Those are all prohibited for lots of very good reasons. In this case, that didn't happen for two reasons. First of all, at its simplest, the compensation system is not based on fees. It's based upon the recoveries the client makes. Now, when I first heard that, my response to it was to say, well, we all know they get a third. And because they get a third, this is just changing the math a bit. You could give her a percentage of one-third of the recoveries and it'd be recognizing the fees. But the problem is that's not true. It's not true of this firm. The evidence is absolutely uncontradicted. No evidence to the contrary that the firm does not get one-third of its recoveries in fees. As a matter of fact, it doesn't collect in any predictable, meaningful way the percentage that the contracts require them, permit them to recover from the recoveries, because the firm, in the uncontradicted evidence, has two longstanding policies that, according to the uncontradicted evidence, although the referee ignored it, have been in effect throughout the time we're talking about. The first one is the firm frequently cuts its fees to facilitate settlements, to keep clients happy, for all the to avoid having to work on cases that are not very profitable, all the reasons lawyers cut fees. Second of all, the firm has an ironclad rule, which has been followed throughout the period we're talking about, that no matter how the math comes out in terms of paying fees, paying liens, paying expenses, paying all the things that personal injury plaintiffs' lawyers have to pay out of settlements, when you get down to the bottom line after you pay all that, there's a number for the client. And if that number for the client from that case is smaller than what the fee would be for the firm reduces its fees so that those two are at least equal. So as a result, the recoveries, although they're the source of the fees, are not the fees. And they're not predictably related in any mathematical way. Now, the response from OLR, apparently accepted by the referee, is that, well, but the idea with this fee-sharing rule is you don't want to give non-lawyers a significant role in having these cases done. And you're sort of giving them an incentive that maybe if they're near the margin at the end of a quarter to kind of sneak in a couple of cases and get them settled, and that's not a good idea. And you know what? Maybe it wouldn't be. I don't know. I don't do a lot of plaintiff's personal injury practice, this afternoon's argument notwithstanding, but I can tell you this, that's not what the rule says. It just doesn't say that. It doesn't say you can't measure the compensation for a paralegal based upon matters which have some indirect, non-predictable, incidental relationship to the fees. And so if you want to adopt that rule, even by this decision, that's fine with us. Just don't apply it retroactively to my client, because, of course, he had no way of knowing that rule existed or that he would be violating it because it didn't exist. There's probably better ways to adopt that rule than doing it in this decision, but they can't, however well-intentioned they might be, change the rule to achieve some goal that they think is a good idea. I don't question their motives in that regard. I question its impact on my client. If someone came to you and said, we're measuring a paralegal's performance or the office manager's performance based on how many files we close out as a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer each year, would anyone think that was sharing fees? No.
What's the point of this kind of compensation arrangement?
I think it is.
What's the purpose?
I have to respond in two ways. Mm-hmm. The first is, I don't think that's very, very well defined in the record, and therefore, to the extent we're talking about the record, I don't think there's a good answer. Second, I think drawing in part from some things that are in the record, in part from logic, it is that
the inference is that
the firm believes that its clientele is well served by having matters handled promptly. I believe they mainly handle smaller personal injury matters, which are capable of being handled fairly quickly and closed out fairly quickly, and it is therefore in the best interest of the clients to have these matters pursued efficiently and resolved quickly. And Ms. Voloshin, the paralegal in question, is viewed as being an integral part of that process. Therefore, they reward her by this measurement to some extent for her work in achieving that.
It's an incentive pay.
Yes, it's an incentive. And to me, it is, except for the way it's measured, which is not fees, it's recoveries, it's no different than if I was to tell someone that they were going to get a bonus based upon how many files that we thought should have been closed out 3 months ago because there's paperwork that has to be done. They haven't gotten around to it. If I went to them and said, I'll tell you what, if you can close and final bill all these files for me, helping me as my paralegal, by the end of March, you'll get a bonus of $10 per file. That wouldn't be sharing fees. I'm not It's not connected to the fees. It's connected to achieving a goal and measuring it that way. But again, if you want to adopt the rule that says I can't do that, I wouldn't argue with you. I'd just like a little notice.
It seems to me we have arguably three pots of money, arguably. And the question in my mind is how much they come together. The norm, as I think set forth in 20.5.4 sub 3, really is paying employees out of profits. That's what most law firms do if you're going to give them a bonus for good work out of your profits. Then you've got lawyer fees, and this seems to be based on clients' recovery. So the lawyer gets his fee in part based on the client's recovery, and then the lawyer's employee gets some fee out of the client's recovery.
By the way, of course, that's the profit as well. The profit comes entirely from the fees. It's just measured by taking another number out of it, just like in Ms. Voloshin's case. The fees are the source of the money. We measure it by a different formula, but it's the fees, either way.
Well, but the question is who's receiving the fees. That's the charges about fee splitting.
But the employees are always receiving fees. The only source of income, practically speaking, we have is fees. The rule says you can't share fees. It doesn't say you can't share the revenue of the corporation. It doesn't say you can't measure employee performance by things which have some indirect relationship to overall performance and revenue. It says you can't commit to sharing fees and pay fees.
In fact, the rule says, or at least suggests, how you're supposed to compensate your employees. Sub 3 says a lawyer or a law firm may include non-lawyer employees in compensation or retirement plans, even though the plan is based in whole or in part on a profit-sharing arrangement. But again, that's profits.
And the reason the rule is written that way is because if you were sharing profits, it would be even closer to sharing fees. Because now you're saying this is the net fees that we have left over, and we're sharing those net fees with you after we paid expenses. And I think the rule is written that way to make it clear that as so long as you have a compensation plan based upon sharing profits, it's okay, even though that comes, in my opinion, perilously close to sharing fees. Because the more fees you earn for us, the more profits there'll be, and then you'll make more money. Whereas in this case, Ms. Voloshin makes the same amount of money whether those cases are profitable for the firm, not profitable for the firm, very profitable for the firm, or marginally profitable for the firm, and whether the fees generated by those cases are large, small, indifferent. The compensation system works exactly the same way. Which is why, of course, it never occurred to my client, nor the person who established it, his predecessor, Alvin Eisenberg, that there was anything wrong with it, and the reason why it was incorporated, because it's not sharing fees. And even if it has some elements that sound like maybe it is, it just isn't. And it is, I suggest, patently unfair to, first of all, cite my client for a rule violation, for violating a rule by rewording it, and second of all, to discipline him for it. As to the other counts, on the question of the non-compete, as we have argued in our brief at length, the basic issue here is whether the agreement with Mr. Eisenberg in 1999 by which he sold his stock in the firm was in essence a retirement agreement. We cannot argue with the referee when the referee points out that the word retirement is used nowhere in it. And the question becomes, if he retired from the practice of law and stayed on as what he was, we say, a greeter, a client handholder on the social and personal level, a skill at which he excels, is that a retirement within the rule? And in this regard, I need to point out one important thing about the finding of the court, of the referee. The only factual finding that was made of any importance to this issue is finding 27. Finding 27 is a very specific and narrow finding. The issue before the referee was never whether Mr. Eisenberg continued to do essentially the same things before he signed the 1999 agreement as he did afterwards. Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Weigel both testified, and they both said Mr. Eisenberg's job duties were exactly the same for all practical purposes before and after the agreement. Where they disagreed was Mr. Weigel said, for practical purposes, he'd ceased practicing law quite some time before 1999. He was meeting and greeting, glad-handing clients, going out. He'd remember people's names that he hadn't seen for years and years and years and talk to them. And I don't mean to belittle that. That's a talent, and it was of help to the law firm. But he wasn't practicing law. That's what Mr. Weigel said. Mr. Eisenberg said, no, I did do that, but I also was sort of the grand old man of the firm, and everyone would come to me with problems, and I would devise strategy for them. What is interesting is the referee never found which one of those was correct. All the referee found in finding 27 is Mr. Eisenberg's job remained the same before and after the agreement. The referee never found he was practicing law in the years immediately before the agreement and never found that he was practicing law afterwards. And when I realized that when I was preparing for this argument, my first question was, why? And I realized immediately, the explanation's clear. OLR has the burden of proving the facts necessary to establish a violation by evidence which
Counselor,
is clear.
You know, there's a term often used in law firms that some attorneys in the firms are called rainmakers. They may not do a lot of the work that their talents generate, but they bring a lot of work into the firm. When I read all this, I interpreted Mr. Eisenberg as being a rainmaker. And rainmakers typically do practice law. They may not take cases to court. They may not sit down and write out bylaws or articles of incorporation that another lawyer does, but they do generate confidence in people with legal problems and give them at least some start down the road to saying, well, you need this for your company, or, well, I think you may have a claim for that because you come in and see me, and then one of the other lawyers in the firm deals with it. And I understood he was a rainmaker. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely what you say is true of many lawyers. And it was at some point probably largely true of Mr. Eisenberg. But the testimony of Mr. Weigel was he only did the first. He didn't do the second. They could have had a PR guy sitting in the lobby who knew people and would come in and greet them and attract business, and he would have been performing the same function as Mr. Eisenberg. But the key point here, if I might, Justice Rogensack, is that the referee did not make a finding that he was practicing law before 1999, number one. And number two, if my client did violate that rule, it was because of his perception that Mr. Eisenberg was not practicing law before that and wasn't practicing law afterwards. And so even if he's found to have violated the rule, it puts his conduct in a different context, which is relevant for sanctions.
Okay, thank you.
The second issue that I think needs to be considered is what I think are some unfair comments by the referee in the sanctions discussion. They're not findings. You don't owe them any special deference. And basically, what the referee said is Mr. Weigel violated the rules on the firm name because he's a greedy person who wanted to make a lot of money. And I'll let you read the record, and I'll let you make up your own mind. That's not true. Mr. Weigel explained that when Mr. Eisenberg left the firm, and started his own firm and started, in Mr. Weigel's view, competing improperly, a subject you have already addressed in a separate proceeding, that what he was concerned about was primarily the fact that the firm had invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in publicizing the brand name, I knew I'd have to say it again, Eisenberg, Weigel, Carlson, Blau, and Clemens. And that what he did is attempt to protect the firm's interest in that. If that's greed, that's the way somebody else looks at it. I don't see it that way at all. We can't dispute the fact that Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Weigel, in some of the things he did in using the name, did go past the line. It's a question of bad judgment. It's not a question of a bad lawyer. The last comment I want to make on that is he's criticized because he sent a letter out saying after Mr. Eisenberg left, nothing had changed at the law firm. It's our position that statement, particularly for an advertising statement, is pretty darn accurate. I wish all the advertising I saw was as accurate as that. Nothing had changed. No matter whether I accept Justice Rogensack's view of Mr. Eisenberg being a rainmaker or you accept my view of it, the fact of the matter is he wasn't in any meaningful way providing substantive legal advice for clients. He might have been bringing business in the door, but for clients, had anything changed at the law firm in terms of the people who were doing the work at the firm, the answer is, I think, clearly yes. The answer is, at minimum, arguably yes, and that's all it has to be for the use of that phrase in a informational letter to clients to be accurate. It is our position that you should conclude absolutely that the fee-sharing charge is simply misplaced. There is no improper sharing of fees with a paralegal here. That leaves us with unfortunate conduct with regard to the advertising and the firm name. Understandable, I think, in many respects, but unfortunate. And a brief mistake or error with regard to the non-compete. A non-compete which was put in the agreement by everyone's testimony by Mr. Eisenberg's lawyer, who insisted it go in there. That's what Mr. Eisenberg said. That's what Mr. Weigel said. I don't know why. The first time I heard it, I thought it made no sense, but it's the uncontradicted testimony in the case that Mr. Eisenberg's lawyer insisted it go in there, and Mr. Weigel went along with it. That conduct, particularly in light of the fact that for very similar conduct, Mr. Eisenberg got a private reprimand a few months ago, doesn't warrant a suspension. It warrants, at worst, a public reprimand. And a public reprimand would be a harsh blow for my client after 50 years of essentially spotless performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Attorney Schwarzenbart, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abramson. May it please the Court, Paul Schwarzenbart of Madison, Wisconsin. I have the honor here to appear before the Court today representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. In this case, I serve a dual role. I am both the designee of the director on this case as well as its counsel. This matter comes before the Court on the appeal of Joseph Weigel from the report and recommendation of referee Christine Harris-Taylor. Referee Taylor did issue a detailed report and recommendation, which counsel has alluded to today. That's in the appendix to the appellant's brief. In any case that comes before the court, the standards of review are critical. Findings of fact are affirmed unless they're clearly erroneous. I think there's a couple of findings that are being attacked here, but I believe there's acquiescence to the findings and conclusions as to count two. The court defers to the findings of the referee as to witness credibility. The court doesn't substitute inferences for those drawn by the referee. The court independently reviews the legal conclusions drawn by the referee and, of course, independently reviews the recommendation for discipline. By way of summary, this case presents disciplinary claims that arose out of a dispute between two very experienced lawyers, and it arose out of an agreement, the stock redemption agreement, which is Exhibit 2 in the record, that does not conform to the rules of professional responsibility. That agreement was entered into in March of 1999. Attorney Johnson urges on behalf of Mr. Weigel that agreement was intended to be a retirement agreement. Mr. Eisenberg disputes that. The agreement, of course, does not contain the word retirement in it. Argument advanced in the brief was that this was actually an agreement to sell the practice under Supreme Court Rule 20:1.17. In the response brief of OLR, we've addressed whether or not that agreement conforms with 20:1.17. We would submit that it does not. The defense to including a non-compete agreement in an agreement between attorneys would be that it was an agreement concerning retirement. The burden would be on Mr. Weigel to show that defense to the claim. I don't believe he met the burden of proving compliance with 20:1.17 because the agreement did not provide for the sale of the entire practice by Mr. Eisenberg to the firm. It was the redemption of stock. Combined, or as a part of that stock redemption agreement, The firm agreed to employ Mr. Eisenberg. The language of the employment agreement we would submit is clear and unambiguous. It describes Mr. Eisenberg as an employee. It refers to him providing professional services to the firm and to its clients. It refers to him having a draw. It provides for malpractice insurance for him. He's treated just like any other attorney employed by the firm. And lastly, there is no indication there was any notice given to clients of Mr. Eisenberg leaving the practice in 1999 when the stock was sold. There's no suggestion that Mr. Eisenberg ever went into inactive practice. He stayed on at the firm. I believe that the testimony is correct, as Mr. Johnson alluded to. The parties agree. Mr. Eisenberg continued in the same capacity after that stock redemption as he had been acting in before. He met with clients. He talked to clients. He discussed their cases with them or their potential cases. He had some role in bringing business into the firm. And, in fact, Mr. Weigel testified that one reason the firm didn't simply get rid of Mr. Eisenberg in 1999 was that the Eisenberg name was extremely valuable. They wanted to keep the name. They wanted to keep the name Eisenberg there as an attractor of clientele. As Justice Rogensack referred to him, his role as being a rainmaker. That didn't change. And I would suggest that this ties into the second count, which is no longer being contested, but essentially these two counts one and two, are very closely related because they go together in explaining the conduct of Mr. Weigel after the eruption of the shareholder, or the former shareholder, the dispute between Mr. Weigel and Mr. Eisenberg that resulted in Mr. Eisenberg either leaving the firm or being forced out. It really doesn't make any difference how you view it, but he left in February of 2005. A series of letters were exchanged between counsel at that point when the dispute is going on, and Mr. Eisenberg's counsel made it very clear. I don't want you using my name and the name of the firm anymore. I'm forming my own firm. Mr. Weigel and his firm continued to use the name Eisenberg in their firm name for another 2 years, capitalizing on the goodwill associated with Mr. Eisenberg's name, using that name for rainmaking purposes as the years went on before finally, in December of 2006, they abandoned the use of the name. They agreed to change the firm name to Weigel, Carlson, Blau, and Clemens, and no longer use the name Eisenberg. There hasn't been much attention devoted to the second claim because I think it sheds a very poor light on Mr. Weigel's conduct in this situation. And I think it demonstrates a common theme among the defense to the three claims here. The common theme is semantics.
Common theme is what?
Semantics.
Thank you.
I mean, there's a place for semantics in the law, but the semantics here are tortured. A stock redemption agreement with an employment agreement is a retirement agreement. Why? Because Mr. Weigel wants it to be a retirement agreement. It's his wishful thinking, so the agreement gets reversed and engineered into a retirement agreement. Mr. Weigel justified the use of the Eisenberg name after the March 10 date that his own counsel had said in a letter to opposing counsel. And that's in the record. I believe it's Exhibit 11, but there was a letter sent from Mr. Weigel's counsel saying, we concede we can no longer use the name Eisenberg after March 10 of 2005. Well, voila, pull a rabbit out of a hat. On March 3, Mr. Weigel enters and his firm enter into an agreement with Donald Eisenberg, called an of counsel agreement, and for paying him $1,500 a month, they borrowed the use of Donald Eisenberg's name and used that name to justify continuing to use the corporate name of Eisenberg, Weigel, Carlson, Blau, and Clemens. Exhibit 101 submitted at trial by on behalf of Mr. Weigel is ethics opinion E93. And he claimed that that opinion supported the decision to continue to use the name Eisenberg in the firm name based upon the Donald Eisenberg agreement. If the court reads ethics opinion E93, which was it's actually an opinion by our ethics committee adopting an older ABA opinion, if the court reads that opinion, the opinion says the opposite of what Mr. Weigel touted that opinion to mean. So I would suggest that's why there is no longer a defense being advanced to that. But I bring it up because it again points to the theme of semantics. That brings me to the third count, which is this fee-splitting agreement. And again, I would suggest this is purely semantics. The Supreme Court rule at issue basically provides that thou shalt not share legal fees. There's a number of exceptions to the rule to clarify, well, what kind of agreements are okay, recognizing the reality of the fact that revenues into a law firm inevitably come from fees. So by definition, if you're paying an employee a salary, yes, the source of the salary is fees.
Can you give a paralegal a bonus?
I think the rule says, yes, you can give a paralegal. There's nothing wrong with giving a bonus. The question is, how is the bonus measured? In this case, we have two forms of bonus. And in viewing and looking at whether or not this defense is simply sham or semantics, what I would suggest is that the court look at the reality here, which is the source of the fees are the client's gross recoveries. This is a personal injury firm. There's no dispute that the fees earned are contingent fees. So in any case involving a contingent fee, you start with the universe of the client's gross recovery. That gross recovery is then going to be divided up and paid out to various people. The contingent fee agreements ordinarily would be 25%, 33% if it's tried, 40% if the case goes to an appeal. I don't dispute the fact that in many cases the law firm is going to compromise its fee claim to settle a personal injury case. That's part of doing business. There's no question about that. But if you look at the universe of the gross recovery, component one of this fee agreement basically gives this particular paralegal $30 of every $1,000 of the gross recovery. Basically, what the law firm is promising her is a piece of the action on the recovery. The law firm is only going to get a piece of that action if they get some money on their contingent fee. Whether it ends up that the contingent fee that they earn, let's say per $1,000, presumably the law firm gets $250 subject to adjustments. This paralegal is going to get $30 out of that. So she's getting a percent of.
Counsel, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is basically it's the money that's being split is the fees, number one. Number two, it gives the paralegal a personal piece of the action. Contingent fees at common law, I believe, were unlawful, whether it was Champetree or Barratree. There was a common law rule against contingent fees. We created an exception to that in the American system over the years, but it's limited to lawyers. I've cited a case out of Iowa, and it's one of a number of examples the court can find where it's clear paralegals are not allowed to recover contingent fees. It's an illegal contract. So basically, the defense that's being offered here is, well, it's not fee splitting because we're facilitating the paralegal getting paid pursuant to an illegal contract. That's absurd. I would submit that's absurd.
If a law firm goes to court and a paralegal's been working night and day on a
few big cases for a couple of years and sits there during the trial and is handing the lawyer documents and is really helpful to that lawyer, and then they end up winning that case and winning big, the lawyer can't give the paralegal a bonus.
Pay her a bonus out of profits. Don't pay her a bonus that's measured on a percentage of the recovery, because basically what you're doing then is you're facilitating.
Explain to me the difference so I know what you mean by that. Pay her out of profits. Don't pay her a percentage of recovery.
Well,
what's the difference?
Let me backtrack on that a bit, because at trial, the defense that was offered to this claim is that this is simply a profit-sharing arrangement. It was pointed out that, and I think one of the justices commented on this, there's no guarantee that a law firm is going to be profitable at the end of the year. There may not be any profits to pay out. The problem with that arrangement, again, it's the same problem that's endemic to contingent fee arrangements.
So can a lawyer do that or not? I'm just not, because
Excuse me. I think if the law firm said at the end of the year, we've got a profit, we've got profits to share among the shareholders here, let's say we got $400,000 of profits to share among 10 lawyers. Under our agreement, we'd split it up $40,000 apiece. We're so happy about the job you did, we'll give you $10,000. There's not a problem with that. That would be fine.
But you have to wait to the end of the year? That's the difference? You can't.
I don't know.
I'm just trying to figure it out, because it's not clear to me, so I need you to help.
The problem is basing it on the gross recovery, because that converts it into unlawful practice of law, because that way the paralegal is being paid a portion of the contingent fee that the paralegal would not otherwise be entitled to, because it would be an illegal contract.
So if a paralegal is a real estate paralegal and the firm lands, 400 closings, and the paralegal helps with those closings, because that's not contingent fee-based, then that the paralegal can get a bonus?
They can get a bonus. The thrust of the theory on both of these fee-splitting claims, and I want to be candid about it, is the method of computing them. They are computed on the basis of gross recoveries. The impact of doing it that way essentially is to put the paralegal in the position as if, in this case it's a she, as if she was one of the lawyers receiving a piece of that contingent fee.
Counsel, there's something in my mind that says, so what? But I'll tell you what I want you to elaborate on is the so what that the referee opined on. And that is the so what that it provides an incentive. This kind of fee structure provides an incentive for the paralegal to be closing files. That's what I recall. And I would like you to agree or disagree or explain that further.
Well, I entirely agree with that. I mean, that's there is an inherent conflict of interest between lawyer and client in any contingent fee agreement, because the lawyer gets a piece of the action. That is a practice which the court has okayed, and it's been okay for long before any of us were here. But it's an inherent conflict. And the reason is because the lawyer's living depends on getting in money. And the lawyer has to balance the client's best interests in a contingent fee case against the lawyer's financial interest in that case. And the rules tell us the lawyer has to defer to the client. The paralegal is not subject to rules of professional responsibility. The paralegal has a piece of the action. The paralegal, the sooner the money comes in, the better. Under this quarterly bonus system, I think that's where the most danger is, because in that system, the paralegal is getting 25% of the excess between a total figure and a goal. And what that means is if the paralegal is at or near that goal, coming up on a quarter, there is an incentive. Let's rush a bunch of cases in to settle right now so I can exceed the goal, get way above the goal, because once I get above that, under this formula, I get 25% I mean, that does.
Settle? Can a paralegal legally settle a case? They can work a case up. They can help work on a case. They can assist the lawyer in being prepared. They can pull documents. They can. I'm not aware of paralegals legally settling cases. They can help work them up.
I don't know if it's in this record, but the paralegal in this case, I know, had signed letters identifying herself as a claim negotiator. I believe that the facts here are that she was part of a team supervised by Mr. Weigel, and that ultimately cases would be settled within settlement parameters under the direction of the attorneys. But, you know, we don't dispute this was a competent paralegal. We don't dispute she worked hard. She did have direct contact negotiating settlements. Under under an ethics opinion from 1978, I think this the committee, prior committee, had said there's not a problem with paralegals negotiating settlements under the supervision of a lawyer. So I think the answer is, and we haven't brought that as an ethical violation in this case, in large part because of the fact that there's this longstanding opinion out there that we don't believe there's evidence that the practice at this firm was any different than what is suggested is okay under the rule, that, in fact, the paralegal did engage in direct negotiations. She did it as part of the team where at least several lawyers were involved. And therefore, yes, she could influence whether or not a case did get settled at a particular time, although as part of a team, including lawyers. So, again, we view this, again, looking at a pie chart, whether the law firm negotiates its fee down from $250 per thousand to $150, the paralegal is still getting her cut of that out of those fees. The problem with the 25% rule is the same problem. It's structured a little bit differently, but it has the same problem in making the paralegal essentially a de facto sharer in contingent fees that would otherwise be unlawful because she's not an attorney. Therein lies the danger. It's not a profit-sharing type of arrangement. It's certainly not a retirement profit-sharing type of arrangement. It's not a profit-sharing arrangement that is dependent upon profits at the end of the year. I mean, under this system, the firm could lose money, and Ms. Voloshin would still be entitled to her bonus if she earned it under the system.
Well, the firm could be losing money. She'd still be entitled to her compensation. When you have a flat compensation, you earn, you can fill in the number, $60,000 a year. Firm could lose money. Partners have to dig in and pay it.
But in addition to that, my point, Judge, is that if Ms. Voloshin earned her 30 cents per thousand plus her 25% over the quota, that's still got to be paid. It's not being paid out of profits.
Why isn't that more like compensation? Why isn't that more like just a different way of stating what she's going to earn?
The problem, as I view it, and as this issue was framed, is that it becomes the sharing of a contingent fee arrangement, which is unlawful for anyone but an attorney to engage in.
Well, you're not supposed to share fees regardless of whether they're contingent or not. I don't think the rule is limited. And how does this argument that you are propounding fit with the firm? Basically, as a business firm, doesn't do a lot of contingency fee work, maybe 95% is business work, and at the end of the year, every lawyer is pounding on the door of every client who hasn't paid for work done so that the work will come in. Bills are routinely compromised to get a payment before the end of the year, and members of the firm who are not lawyers share in that. They may share in it by what they get, but they also share in it by following up on calls and getting the money in the door. How does that square with what you see as prohibited here?
I think the answer to that is the rule basically states a broad prohibition, thou shalt not share fees, and then it has certain exceptions as to what is permissible.
So what about an arrangement where a lawyer has the standard, maybe it's not standard to me, 25, 33, 40, and internally the standard is that the lawyer who brought in the business gets 8% of whatever is done. The lawyer who handles it does the work. And there may be several, they share. You can put in whatever number you want, percent you want. And the paralegal who works it gets a less percent. So maybe the lawyer who works it gets 20%, and the paralegal gets 3%. Would that be a good deal? I mean, it may be a good deal for all these people, but is it a valid deal?
It's not valid as to the paralegal. It would be as to the lawyers. The lawyers are permitted to do that. The non-lawyers are not permitted to share
now,
in that fashion.
Under the old rules, and I didn't go back and check this, but there was a rule that prevented fee splitting, as it was called. And that was so if lawyer A got the business but really didn't do personal injury, could give it to a firm that did, but wanted a cut, didn't work on the case, may have spent 20 minutes with the client, and then tossed it over. Is that rule still in existence?
I think that like Mr. Johnson, I don't do a lot of plaintiff's personal injury work, but I think that rule has been modified somewhat in recent years to allow for, I'll call them finder's fees, mm-hmm. More liberally than it used to be. It used to be that as co-counsel, you had to substantively work on the file and there had to be some
reasonable
basis.
Relationship right. For doing that. That was my recollection. But pragmatically and empirically, this was being done all over, not only all over Wisconsin, but all over the country. And it made problems of having many lawyers be violators, and so it's been changed. That's one reason, to conform to practice. So what's the practice, do we know, in the state about paralegals?
With respect to paralegals, I wouldn't attest any personal knowledge concerning this. I can tell you this is, when I heard about this bonus arrangement, it was the first time that I had personally run into it.
I've been listening to the discussion and trying to understand exactly what the evil is. You can say there is a rule, it's a long-standing rule, but what is the evil that comes out of even violating the rule?
Well, I think it's the evils are twofold. Number one is the potential incentivization of settlements to maximize a bonus, number one, and number two, it's the same evil that we're concerned about with respect to contingent fee arrangements with non-lawyers. If you have a non-lawyer here who has what amounts to a stake in the contingent recovery, because it's a stake in the gross recovery, it may affect the handling of that claim because of the non-professional having a stake in it. That might adversely affect the client.
Well, that goes to both one and two. Concept is that the paralegal is not governed by the rules that govern lawyers. Paralegal has a personal incentive. Now, we agree lawyers, too, have a personal incentive. They want the fee in because they're not paid until the client recovers, and they've got to pay their bills regardless, or should be paying their bills regardless. So you don't want incentives to non-lawyers that will compromise the client.
Right.
And that's the assumption here, is that the paralegal has significant influence and power to do something with relation to the file that may be in the paralegal's interest but not in the client's.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think the fact that the base salary for this paralegal, who's highly valued and highly competent, is barely above minimum wage. It suggests that she does have a big incentive to try to boost her earnings through these programs.
If the paralegal negotiates settlements, I thought you said that that wasn't prohibited.
They're doing it under the supervision of an attorney.
Okay.
I think there's an ethics opinion, 78-something. I don't have it here before me, but it's from 1978 is my recollection.
The real question is how much they're supervised.
That's correct, and that, you know, that we can't be there in the office knowing how much supervision is going on, but according to this ethics opinion, the fact that the paralegal may have direct contact with an insurance company to negotiate a settlement is not per se an ethical violation.
No, because the insurance company can negotiate it with non-lawyers.
That's true, and sometimes they do.
But is there any evidence here that that evil is part of the record or that happened here?
No, we don't have anything in the record. There were no complaints by any clients who felt that they had been injured by this. This claim was brought to challenge the validity of this type of bonus program that's predicated on a measure using client gross recoveries.
Does your theory only apply in a case where the paralegal negotiates a settlement? I thought you were saying it's broader than that.
Well, I think it's broader than that because, again, it's like sharing a contingent fee.
But then back to Justice Prosser's question, what's the harm in that? If in the end you win big at a jury trial, the paralegal really helped out, they work night and day on that case, they don't get paid hourly, you know, there's a huge verdict, and then the lawyer says, you know what, you worked so hard on this case, you deserve a blank bonus. But that's wrong. The lawyer has to wait till the end of the year, see what the firm's profits are, and then decide whether or not, based upon the firm's profits, regardless of the litigation section of the firm, the whole firm's profits, then you can only basically – I'm not getting it. I'm not getting exactly what lawyers can and cannot do under this theory. It looks like it just shouldn't give bonuses out to paralegals.
I guess maybe I'm not successfully conveying it, but Mike, the concern that is raised by this has to do with the sharing of contingent fees. It's because they're contingent fees.
They couldn't share them if they were not. Counselor, correct? I mean, if someone comes in, they have bylaws drawn up and the agreement is they're going to pay you $500 to draw the bylaws, you can't say, well, for every bylaws you draw, paralegal, you get 100 of the 500? You can't do that, can you?
That would be fee splitting. I think that would be fairly blatant. I think the distinction that's attempting to be drawn here is we're not promising Ms. Voloshin 25% of our net fee. We're giving her a cut of the gross recovery because we may reduce our fee.
Yeah.
So her percentage of the fee may change because the firm is compromising its fee claim, but she's still getting a part of the fee.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Schwarzenbart. Mr. Johnson?
I'd like to try to address just a couple of issues here. The first, on the question of whether Mr. Eisenberg obviously did not retire, so my client should have surely seen this as not being a retirement program. Paragraph 1 of the employment agreement found in finding 18 of the referee says, the parties agree that the employee, that's Mr. Eisenberg, will spend most of his time on public relations, promotion, and advertising. The employee will have managerial control over the employer's programs for public relations, promotion, and advertising, and will have a reasonable budget to conduct such programs. I don't think that establishes my client did not err in his understanding of this. I think it gives a flavor of what Mr. Eisenberg was really doing and why my client acceded to Mr. Eisenberg's lawyer's insistence that this, in retrospect, improper restriction be placed in the agreement. Second, there are two problems with what OLHAR said about this alleged fee sharing. The first thing is, it's not what the rule says. The rule doesn't say you cannot have any program in which the performance of the employee's eligibility for that program is tied in some way to matters which have an indirect effect on fees, which is what they say. It says you can't share fees. We didn't have an agreement whereby what this paralegal got was determined by the fees that the firm earned. That's the evil, and it's not violated. And that's not semantics. It's notice to my client.
Let's say I have a client, Wausau Papers, and I charge them on a project a certain amount of money.
Fixed fee?
Yeah, well, maybe fixed fee might be better for hypothetical. It sounds to me like you're saying, take it out of the contingent, CP. It sounds to me like you're saying, as long as the paralegal is assessing against the client pool of money, as opposed to sharing the fee of the attorney, that's okay. That seems to be what you're suggesting.
It's close to that, but it's not quite that, I don't think. I think the rule puts lawyers on notice that you cannot enter into arrangements by which you give non-lawyers a share of the fee. For example, I personally would disagree with the distinction that Mr. Schwarzenbart was drawing. I think if we had a case, paralegal worked very, very hard for a long time, and whether it was because of a favorable hourly rate or because we got in more business from that client, or we just got a big contingent fee. If at the end of the day I say, you know what, I want to reward that paralegal for all that time they put in, we're going to give her a $5,000 bonus. I don't have to wait till the end of the year. That's not fee sharing. That's me rewarding good work. And I can measure that any way I want.
Firms do that all the time. They don't have to wait till the end of the year.
And all this formula is using one of the many ways the firm could use to measure what it considers to be desirable performance by this paralegal. And it isn't tied to her settlements. It isn't tied to the results she gets. It's tied to the performance of the unit she works in which she performs lots of functions, a very small portion of which is any sort of direct settlement negotiations. That's the record here. But let me give you the last example, which proves why we're right and they're wrong. And it's not just semantics. If we settle a case for $10,000, I recall he said $30 per thousand. The paralegal would get a $300 posting to this potential bonus at the end of the year. If to settle it for $10,000, because it turns out it's an impossible case, we can't win, it's the best we can get, but the client needs to get some money out of it, they take no fees. She gets her $300 and they get no fees. How can a program which encompasses that possibility be sharing fees? It cannot be. Because, of course, it's not sharing fees.
No, it's sharing in the recovery by the client.
It's measuring the employee's eligibility to be paid additional funds by one of, I could think of 100 ways I could measure the performance. Closing files, the length of time that goes by from the time we settle the case to the time we actually get the money.
Counsel, but here, from the outset, your argument on these facts is your client, that the paralegal is sharing in the client's recovery. That's what you were saying. It's not the attorney's fees. It's 30 cents on $1,000 of the client's recovery. Isn't that what you're saying?
That's my response to differentiate from what they're saying. It's not sharing fees. It's measuring one portion of her compensation by one of the ways we think we can measure her value.
And where does that come from? Where does that 30 cents come from then?
That 30 cents comes from the gross revenue of the firm in some sense, or from money the firm borrows if there isn't enough profit in the firm to pay all the expenses and pay her salary.
So what I understood, and maybe it's my misunderstanding of the first part of your argument, when I was talking about you have fees, you have profits, and you have client recovery. I understood you to be making the difference that this isn't attorney's fees. She's getting 30 cents out of $1,000 from the client's recovery. This isn't profits either.
The client doesn't pay her. She is being compensated by the firm in the same way she gets salary. The only difference is one way the amount she gets measured is by one parameter of performance they have. It happens that they place a lot of value on the recovery for the client. Probably not a bad thing for a plaintiff's law firm. And therefore, they measure her performance that way. But, for example, if I measured her performance by the number of days she showed up to work on time, if I thought it was really important she be there on time every day, I wanted her at 6 o'clock in the morning because I get in at an ungodly hour, and if she was there every day for a month by that, They would be paid out of the same source, the fees of the firm, but I measured her eligibility for the bonus by using that parameter. It doesn't come out of anything. It's simply a definition of how she gets paid, such as, did we close out the 25 files this month that I told you were lagging in terms of paying all the lien holders and so on and weren't done? Yes, they were. That you then qualified for a $100 bonus this month because you got that one task done that I wanted to have done. The money came out of the fees, because it all does, but it has nothing to do with fee sharing. And more to the point, if it's going to be part of the rule, you ought to tell people, not impose it on them retroactively, which is what OLR is trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Both of you have appeared before in OLR cases, so you know how seriously the court considers OLR cases and how difficult they are, both for the lawyer involved and counsel for the lawyer and counsel for the OLR. And that applies in this case, too. So I want to thank both counsel for their arguments and their briefs. And that ends our hearing in 10 AP 1523D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Joseph W. Weigel. The court's in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. And the students may remain. And Justice Bradley will be out shortly to talk with them. I don't believe that the students from Pius 11 have come. Is that right? They're not. So we have two groups.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
Do
right.
Do we have any?
No.
We have two groups from Golda Meir. We're in recess until 1:30.